Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you for our Tuesday podcast, On My Mind, with last October's confirmation of conservative Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Roe v. Wade faces its greatest threat since it became law back in 1973. But the movement to erode the protections Roe provides has made steady progress at the state level for years, sometimes in the form of fetal personhood laws. To walk us through what these laws are, I talked with Lauren Kelly. She's the New York Times editorial board's women and reproductive rights editor. The New York Times series, A Woman's Rights, will appear in print in a special section Sunday, January 20. Lauren Kelly, the series about abortion that is so interesting is that the women profiled have wanted pregnancies. Explain why you came with this focus.
Yeah, thank you, Diane. And that's right. We felt really strongly when we were conceptualizing this series that it was important to include those stories. Basically, the origin of this started the moment we heard that Justice Anthony Kennedy was retiring this past summer.
Yes.
It was just immediately clear to me and some of my colleagues that Roe v. Wade was obviously going to be a giant issue going forward. And indeed, you know, with the ascension of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, that is exactly where we have found ourselves. So we knew that abortion rights were going to be a huge issue. But, you know, what we really wanted to make clear with this series is that as important as abortion rights are, and they absolutely are central to women's rights and bodily autonomy, there is a bigger issue here. This really is a broad problem of women being criminalized, being punished for the outcomes of their pregnancy, you know, and that includes stillbirths and miscarriages in many cases.
You know, that's really extraordinary. How can a woman be criminalized for a miscarriage? Give me an example.
So these are often very tragic cases, and they're really tragedies compounded upon tragedies.
Sure.
One example I can give you is there was a woman who was 22 years old, pregnant with her third child. This was back in 2010, I believe. She tripped over one of her children's toys and fell down the stairs. You know, that is, again, it's a tragic situation. It's also something that, you know, I am not pregnant right now. And if I were to fall down the stairs, I would certainly need medical care, but this would not be a potential criminal situation.
Exactly.
However, in her case, because she did happen to be pregnant and because when she got to the emergency room, she sort of confided in a nurse there that her marriage was on the rocks. She was having some sort of conflicted and ambivalent feelings about her pregnancy, and she was sort of scared about being a mother of three. And this was taken as some sort of warning sign against her. And she was arrested, charged with attempted feticide, and she ended up spending two nights in jail.
As though she had tripped intentionally and tried to kill the child.
That's right. And in so many of these cases, the laws are written in such a way where they are really expressly not intended to be used against the woman who is pregnant. But you get overzealous prosecutors and you get a growing anti-abortion sentiment around the country. And it's a cocktail for women, in fact, being charged with these sorts of crimes.
Well, it's also a gaining of ground for the idea that a fetus at whatever stage of development has rights. Explain the idea of fetal personhood for us.
Fetal personhood is the idea that a fetus is a legal human being separate and apart from the woman who is carrying that fetus. There are a lot of different laws and legal precedents around the country that have established this notion. And it has been a big focus of the anti-abortion movement for years. The history of this fetal personhood idea is really pretty closely tied to the rise of the anti-abortion movement. So, you know, we start seeing these kinds of laws in the 70s, sort of around when the Roe v. Wade decision was decided. And then you sort of see those efforts ramp up through the 80s, through the 90s, through today. At this point, there are 38 states that have fetal homicide laws, and those are laws that treat a fetus as a potential crime victim separate from the woman carrying it. And I think it is very clear to folks in that anti-abortion movement that this is their moment. They are absolutely aware of the fact, as, you know, we were, that moment when Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement and me and my colleagues just knew instantly what this could mean. They had that exact same level of awareness. They've been working on this for years and years. And so this is their time to shine. We saw just in November, Alabama passed a personhood amendment to their state constitution. So if Roe was overturned, that would go into effect. And I would expect we're going to see more efforts along those lines in the coming months and years.
So we're not just talking about a fetus that may have developed, say, in the fourth, fifth month.
In many cases, that's right. There is a whole sort of patchwork of laws that we're talking about here, and some of them are more strict than others. And some of them, frankly, more well-meaning than others. You can sort of understand where at least some of these laws came from. But yes, some of them, for instance, do not state that the fetus must be viable. So that's right now, typically after 22, 23 weeks or so. Some of them really do potentially criminalize women and other people for harming fetuses, really from a very, very early stage, from the moment of conception.
So we're talking about efforts then to reverse Roe v. Wade in these laws that are being adopted around the country.
That is right. So the issue here is that on a fundamental level, fetal personhood is just incompatible with the Roe v. Wade decision. Justice Harry Blackmun, he wrote in his majority opinion in the Roe decision, this is a quote from him, he said, "If this suggestion of personhood is established, Roe's case, of course, collapses, for the fetus's right to life would then be guaranteed specifically by the 14th Amendment." So he was very aware at the time, as Roe was decided, that if personhood for fetuses was established at the federal level, Roe would fall apart. And again, this is something that the anti-abortion movement is very, very aware of.
So it's kind of a backdoor way to say that personhood is established at the moment of conception to make anything that then happens to that group of cells something you would call infanticide.
Personhood laws and laws that establish legal rights for fetuses more broadly, they raise a lot of legal and frankly kind of philosophical questions. You know, there's questions like, a woman who chooses to smoke a cigarette or have a glass of wine during her pregnancy, would that be a crime? Those things are not illegal right now. You know, there might be certainly guidelines against doing them, but should you be arrested for doing those things? Likewise, you know, let's say a woman is pregnant, whether she knows it or not at that stage, and she goes climbing a mountain or she rides a roller coaster or she goes to a war zone. There's just a lot of questions about what would happen to those women, not to mention women who are pregnant and they get diagnosed with cancer. What if they want to undergo chemotherapy that could harm their fetus? What does that mean? And I think these are the kinds of questions we're grappling with.
You know, all of this, Lauren, really does remind me of Margaret Atwood's remarkably visionary book, The Handmaid's Tale. Would you agree?
You and me both. Absolutely. I actually have to confess here that, of course, the term Handmaid's Tale was invoked a number of times as we were working on this project, because there are a number of stories that really just remind you far too much of it. I do have to admit now, though, that I still have not watched the second season of the Hulu show.
I haven't gotten to it yet either.
I found the first season very upsetting. Yeah. I'm glad it exists. And of course, the book is a masterpiece, but I have not yet brought myself to watch season two. We'll see, maybe this year.
And now a quick break. When we come back, more from Lauren Kelly of the New York Times.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Lauren Kelly, the New York Times editorial board's women and reproductive rights editor. Talk with me about race. Women of color, I gather, are even more likely to be affected by these laws. Tell me why that is.
I want to paraphrase Lynn Paltrow, who is an amazing advocate on these issues. She works at National Advocates for Pregnant Women. She's been sort of ringing these alarm bells for many years. And, you know, she told us as we were working on this series, something that I thought was really smart. She said, you know, what's happening here is we are taking what are fundamentally healthcare issues and we're turning them into criminal law issues. Huh. And, you know, I think a lot of what happens here is that the folks who will most often get tied up in this criminal justice system, they do tend to be poor people. They do tend to be people of color. And they are the same ones who are being affected here. And it's no big surprise.
What about the myth of the crack baby? How does that play into this story?
We felt it was really important to take on that story for a couple of reasons. One, as we say in the piece, was because the New York Times was certainly among the media organizations that sort of helped propagate the bad science that was behind this sort of moral panic over these quote unquote crack babies. There were all sorts of horrible stories out there floating around about how these babies who had been born to mothers who had used crack cocaine while they were pregnant, you know, were going to grow up to be criminals. And, you know, some of the language is really horrifying about how they're, you know, barely human and they're going to have lifelong learning disabilities and health effects. What we know now is that a lot of that did not come to pass. You know, in many cases, those kids caught up with their peers. And the real central fact here is that it's pretty much impossible to separate the health effects and developmental effects of poverty from those of children who were born with crack cocaine in their systems. Again, so we felt it was important for us to sort of own up to that in a sense. And it was also important for us to tackle it because in many ways that crack cocaine sort of moral panic set the stage for a lot of what we see today with the opioid epidemic.
Yes.
So one of the stories in our series deals with a woman named Casey Dishman. She has struggled with opioid addiction for many years, and basically she is now struggling to regain custody of her children. And we just felt like we could not tell that story of this white woman, you know, struggling with these issues, as, you know, is the case for so many folks today dealing with the opioid epidemic, without really grappling with that, again, origin story from the 80s and 90s. You know, we saw a lot of policies, a lot of social attitudes really set during that period, during the crack epidemic.
So you're suggesting that there are non-consensual drug testing going on with women who may be pregnant and may be into opioids. And that obviously violates their constitutional rights.
And a lot of these cases, it has to be said, do end up getting sort of cleared up relatively quickly, some more quickly than others. But in the meantime, you know, babies are pulled from their mothers really right after the moment that they're born. And, you know, it might be a few days, it might be weeks or months while this sort of gets sorted out. But in the meantime, the mom might be behind bars or otherwise separated from her baby. And look, you know, if there's one thing that we know from the research of what to do in cases when a baby is born with drugs in their system or when their, you know, mother has used drugs while she was pregnant, it's that they really should be attached to their mother as much as possible. Most of the evidence today suggests that the way that we should treat babies born with drugs in their system is really the same way that we should treat any baby. Skin-to-skin contact, time with the mother, breastfeeding when possible. And so those early separations can really, you know, do a lot of damage both to mom and to baby.
Lauren, give us the details about the case of Marlies Munoz and what it says about how some of these laws actually play out.
So Marlies Munoz was a woman in Texas in her early 30s. She was a paramedic. And so perhaps unlike a lot of folks in their 30s, she actually had had a lot of conversations with her family about her end-of-life wishes. She had seen firsthand what it was like for folks to sort of live on machines, and she was very clear that she never wanted to be in that situation ever. So a very tragic thing did happen to her. She had a pulmonary embolism. Her husband found her face down and not breathing on their kitchen floor in the middle of the night. She had probably been there for some time, and rushes her to the hospital. Now, it turns out Marlies was 14 weeks pregnant the time with her second child. Mm-hmm. Again, these are all just tragedies compounded upon tragedies. So they get to the hospital. They're doing CPR. They're trying to get her heart to start again. They can't. And the family is all absolutely clear. We have to let her go. This is what she wanted. We do not want to, you know, keep her on machines. Like, just let her rest in peace. But as it turns out, the hospital informed her there is a law in Texas. And as it turns out, there are somewhat similar laws in 30 some odd states around the country. And that law states that if a woman is pregnant, those end-of-life wishes can be discarded. Okay. So what they told the family was that she would have to be put on machines, and she was. This is really, again, just a horribly tragic situation. As it turns out, Marlies was brain dead, so she was legally dead. So really, the law never should have applied to her because, again, she was not alive. But it took 62 days for this to play out. The hospital's lawyers kept insisting that to comply with Texas law, she did have to be kept on those machines. And the poor family just was put through hell, really. They kept visiting her in the hospital. Her body was, you know, really decomposing. And this was all in the name, again, of protecting this, what started out as a 14-week fetus. Viability, again, doesn't start until 20 some odd weeks. And so they were going to have to keep her on those machines for some time to even have any chance of that baby surviving. As it turns out, the fetus was non-viable, they eventually found. And after the family sued, they were able to get her unhooked from those machines and let her lay to rest.
But it's a terrible story.
It is, and it's a really extreme case, to be sure, but it does raise a lot of questions. I mean, again, 30-some-odd states have pregnancy exclusion laws of some kind, and if it has happened once, there is a real fear that this could happen again.
Well, take a step back and tell me how successful you believe President Trump's anti-abortion agenda has been.
Quite successful, actually. And, you know, I'm glad you asked that because I think that this is something that a lot of folks don't even realize. You know, obviously, there's been a lot of focus over the last 6 months or so on the future of Roe v. Wade. And that's exactly right. It should be. And that, of course, goes back to President Trump nominating Supreme Court justices. He did promise at one point that he would put justices on the Supreme Court who would overturn Roe v. Wade. That was a promise he made to Americans. And he seems to be at least trying to make good on that promise. But really, outside of that, there are a lot of things happening that if you talk to advocates, they're very concerned about. And they're happening sort of quietly. The Trump administration, through the Department of Health and Human Services, has made a lot of these kind of wonky, confusing rules changes that have had a big effect on women's reproductive rights, and or could, depending on whether they're allowed to go into effect.
Give me an example.
So they've done things like roll back birth control access, or they're trying to, at least. Just yesterday, there was an injunction put on one of their efforts to roll back the birth control mandate in the Affordable Care Act. So they were unsuccessful on that front, which is good news. But there's also something called the domestic gag rule. Again, it's sort of a wonky and complicated thing to explain. But what it ultimately boils down to is that a lot of women could end up losing birth control access and access to other family planning services outside of abortion. There are rules changes they're trying to get into effect dealing with insurance coverage of abortion care. Things that would put up a lot of unnecessary barriers. For instance, this insurance rules change, what they want to do is make it so that any healthcare plans under the Affordable Care Act, what you would have to do is you would pay your monthly premium, but then you would have to pay a separate monthly premium for abortion care, which is crazy. I mean, that's not a normal thing. You would not do that for any other kind of healthcare. And the rules stipulate that this separate payment has to be made through a separate transaction online, or if the bill is mailed to you, it has to be in a separate envelope with a separate stamp. I mean, there's just no really legitimate reason for this other than to gum up the works, make abortion seem stigmatized, separate from quote unquote regular healthcare, and, you know, ultimately in small ways sort of chip away at reproductive access.
Realistically, do you believe that Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned?
I will defer to smarter legal minds than my own on this. But I will say, from having spoken to legal experts, what they typically say is that it is unlikely that Roe will be wholesale overturned. It is absolutely possible, and it's on the table. But another option, which in some ways could be more insidious even, is for it to just be further chipped away at. That is a trend that we've seen for years now. There have been 400 some odd anti-abortion bills passed since, I believe, 2010 is the statistic, and many hundreds more than that introduced. And all of that has had the effect of chipping away at Roe, making it so it is effectively not the law of the land in some parts of the country. There are some parts of the country with only one abortion clinic left. So you can expect to see more efforts like that in the future, and we could expect to see the Supreme Court letting some of those anti-abortion laws stand and potentially just sort of, again, slowly, quietly chipping away at this right without actually overturning it, which is, frankly, a big voting issue on the right. It's a big voting issue for anti-abortion folks, and I think part of them probably wants to keep that.
Lauren Kelly, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Douglas Bell and Natalie Uribe-Lipker. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you on Friday. I'm Diane Rehm.